This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I am joined here with David Cole. David, great having you back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be back, Robert. It really is. I enjoyed our first go-around, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
And I'm also joined here with my alt-of-center co-host, Matthew Pegas.
Great to be here, Robert. Thank you for having me.
Speaking of alt, I want to apologize to you, Robert, because I know a couple months ago in one of my Tachymag pieces, I kind of mischaracterized you in my description of you, and you were very polite about it. You were very nice about it, but I don't like when I do that because, number one, I don't like to make errors in print, but also I don't like it when people mischaracterize me or affix labels to me that I don't want or don't deserve. So I want to just apologize to get things started here, one-on-one here. I'm very sorry. I think I called you alt-righty. And,
or like extreme alt-right or hardcore alt-right.
Okay. Yeah, rub it in. Go ahead. You know, here's a
That's
man.
Okay.
Here's a man trying to, like, grovel, and you take that salt and you rub it right in. Yes, I made a grievous error, Robert, a grievous error, and I apologize for it.
So, let's start with your recent articles, Lessons from My Porn Girl, and just this kind of overall theme is how pornography is the one area in our culture where one is allowed to be politically incorrect. So basically to start things off, by porn girl, you're referencing this woman that you used to know?
Well, woman who lived with me. Woman whose porn name is Kirsten Lee. Her real name is Kara. I'm not outing anybody. She is outed herself. So this is not me doing anything like outing or doxing. Kara lived with me for almost 2 years and was pretty much my partner in crime. She was 21 when I met her, and I basically, my role in her life was to try to help her out of the porn biz. It's a business that has never interested me, but it was fascinating during that first year that she and I were together before she got out of it, because by the second year, she was fully out. You know, the amazing thing about a porn girl is that once you give them free rent and utilities and food, they no longer feel the need to seek money. And, well, they can just get right out of porn at that point. It's really a miraculous formula. Once they don't have any needs or bills to pay or anything like that, well, getting out of porn seems pretty simple at that point.
So you touch on the theme of how pornography is the one aspect of media where politically incorrect content is not only tolerated but promoted and garners massive hit counts and profits. What was the specific case with her and her politically incorrect attitudes about sexual relations and porn?
Well, I was amazed, really quite amazed, by the people I mixed with during that first year when she was still knee-deep, neck-deep in the business. On racial matters, the kind of stuff that is the most taboo for the rest of us to talk about, on racial matters, porn is just insanely honest. You know, I'm not affixing a good or bad label to it, or healthy or unhealthy, just saying it's incredibly honest. White girl comes in and white girl says, I'm not going to blow an N-word. And the producers of porn companies like, great, you don't do the N-word porn. Kara, my porn girl, made most of her money doing interracial stuff because since she was so young and very thin and kind of pristine, for lack of a better word, it was kind of rare to have a white girl like that do interracial because normally it's like the older women who've put on a few pounds who do the interracial. but for a blonde girl, blue eyes, 21 years old and looking like she's just come right off the fjords, she made a great deal of money at that. But yet in her private life, she would never do interracial. That this is the thing that fascinated me the most about how she was able to compartmentalize the racial thing. When she's at work and she gets $8,000 to go down on a black dude, well, that's just work. She just does it. And then we're out in a club and some black guy tries to hit on her, maybe because of her porn, and she'll let loose just a stream of expletives. You freaking N-word, you N-word this, you N-word that. In her mind, it's just, hey, I'm at work. I'm at work, and my work right now is blowing a black guy. And then when we're out at a club later that night, hey, this is my private time. I don't want to talk to a black guy. But the whole industry was just sort of honest that way. Most of the women would, including black girls too, and the Latino girls, they were just very honest, because you can talk about race in porn in a way that you can't in real life. As I make the point in my article, where else in American society right now can pay scale be determined by your race? I mean, if any other business, if Amazon were to say we're going to be paying white programmers more than Asian ones, well, of course, it would be a huge thing, and I'm not advocating that at all. But in porn, white girls who are willing to do black guys make more. White girls who only want to do other white girls make the least, because that's, you know, hell, any white girl will kiss another white girl these days. In my day, that was barely titillating, and I think everyone kind of does that now. So, and then the Mexican dudes, there were some Arab dudes, and they get paid different based on race. It doesn't happen anywhere else. I mean, it's kind of astounding when I was looking at it, and I've spent years writing about racial politics and racial law and discrimination laws, and I'm like, wow, this is the Wild West. This is a part of the entertainment industry and a profitable one that has yet to be touched by that leftist hand of politically correct social justice bullshit.
And not only race, even just looking at the whole climate with the whole Me Too thing and just feminism in general, there's in general with like gender issues, there's all this hypersensitivity, and then you can look at pornography, and there's stuff that I guess you could say is extremely degrading, and the whole theme of men humiliating women, and the theme of eroticized rage, and yeah. a lot of feminists will say that like men watch porn as a way to kind of express their anger towards women, and Luke Ford has talked about that in his play Eroticized Rage, and about his porn habits as a way to see the kind of women who he felt snubbed by being utterly humiliated. So feminists make that argument, and there's definitely truth to that. But pornography, that's an industry that tolerates stuff. So stuff that would be viewed as either extremely racist or misogynist in any other form of media is tolerated in porn, which is interesting, because what do you think it is? Do you think it's just that there's something different about sexuality, or do you think that because it's pornography, because pornography is viewed as kind of shady, it's beyond the bounds of what's respectable?
I think a lot of it comes down to the fact, another point that I make in my article, which is that porn is arguably the last arm of the entertainment industry that caters to its fan base with no hesitation. Now, as I found out through Kara, one very important demographic in that fan base are, as you just mentioned, the dudes who want to see women humiliated or hurt. I found that when I, because I have friends who are very much into porn. I'm not, and when I say I'm not into porn, I said that in my article. People are like, oh, that's what all guys say. It's like saying you don't masturbate. Well, no, some guys really are not into porn. I'm just not really into porn. But one of the things that I found very interesting is the friends that I have who are into the humiliation and the rough stuff when they're watching porn. They would respond with tremendous hostility, tremendous negativity when I would tell them that it's staged, because I saw that it's staged. One example is my porn girl, Kara, was in a film with James Dean, D-E-E-N, who's been accused of rape in real life. But James Dean's thing in porn is the abuse, the humiliation, the physical violence. Now, she did a film anyone wants to see. There's like Kirsten Lee, James Dean, you know, you find the links. But in the film, it really does look like she's just getting the shit kicked out of her. She was a mediocre actress for real stuff. It's like you give her Shakespeare, Eugene O'Neill, something like that. She's going to struggle with it. But she was a really, really good porn actress. And if you watch the film she did with James Dean, you really do think that she's being abused and humiliated. But they were both completely in control during the entire shoot. And in fact, they were joking and laughing between takes. But when I would say this to some of my porn friends, my porn fan friends, and I would say, well, you know, they were just making it up, and it would like break their illusion. They'd be like, no, she really is getting hurt. I can tell. I can see it in her eyes. And I'm like, dude, I was there. No, she's not getting hurt. These are two professionals in their field who are fully in control, like a dance number or like a kung fu scene, like a fight scene in a movie. They're not really fighting, but their job, they're both getting paid over 10, well, she was paid about 10 grand. He was probably paid more because he's a star, but she made 10 grand. She's being paid 10 grand to make it look realistic. But no, she was not hurt. She was not humiliated. She was not actually choked. He was a pro. She was a pro. So these guys who like the humiliation aspect of it and the violence aspect of it, they respond almost like you're questioning their faith. Like maybe Jesus isn't the savior. No, not true. Maybe Joseph Smith.
Yeah, but even though it's staged, I'm sure like doing some of those scenes with like having three guys in like all your orifices or taking the ejaculate of like 100 different guys, I'm sure that's extremely degrading to the actresses. Or the performers?
It depends on the woman. Now, to be fair, and as a caveat, my porn girl only did the high-paying stuff. She worked for the companies that still make a good profit. And one of the reasons they make a good profit is they have the money to keep the pirated stuff offline. You have to go to their sites in order to see what they do. They have high production values, prettier women, and generally, I don't want to say better plots, but one of the films that my porn girl did for a company called Teens in the Woods, where she plays a woman, her and her lesbian lover go out in the woods, they make love in the woods, then the lesbian lover wanders off, and Kara is left looking for her. She comes to a cabin where this creepy guy is there, and she's like, have you seen my friend? And he's like, I'll tell you where your friend is if you do this to me and that to me. And that one gets raw. I mean, there's whippings, and there's screaming, and there is torture porn. But again, absolutely nothing for real. Now, having said that, yeah, there's the amateur stuff. There's definitely the amateur stuff where women who are not getting paid well and who are disposable in the eyes of the industry, or that part of the industry, do get humiliated. But, you know, Kara laid down the law with all the companies. There were two things she wouldn't do. No anal, no feces. So nothing to do with the butt, and don't get poop or pee anywhere near her. And everyone was fine with that. If she had said, I do anal, well, then they would have had her do anal. But when these girls, at her level, they actually do have the ability to regulate what they do, and they only do what they're comfortable with. But some of them are very good actors. They're just, you can't be fooled by how sleazy the industry is and how bad they may be as actresses outside the industry. In that industry, they can sell it. And Kara sure as hell can sell it. You see the film she did with James Dean and the one that the Cabin in the Teens in the Woods one. It really does look raw. And if I had seen it from a different perspective, not having seen it being made and know about it, knowing about it being made, yeah, I probably would have believed it was real.
And you make a fascinating point about censorship. So there's been this massive purge on social media and of Stefan Molyneux and Alex Jones and just lots of dissident figures. And basically on a tube site in pornography, you're not going to be censored unless you do something that's explicitly illegal. So there's basically freedom of speech. So if you make a porn video using the N-word, you're not going to have your video taken down from a tube site.
That is literally a subgenre. You can go to Pornhub, which at any given week will be anywhere from the number 5 to number 10 most visited website in the world. You can go to Pornhub and look up N-word porn, and there are dozens and dozens of videos of black dudes or black women either doing things or having things done to them while the N-word is spoken. It's something that people actually seek out and do. Same thing with Muslims. You can find porn that involves the hijab or the burqa, and where they talk about Muhammad. I mean, that kind of stuff would get you killed. That kind of stuff would get you assassinated.
Well, I would think they would be in danger of being of that from radical Muslims.
It's funny that has never come up yet, because, yeah, you would think, especially because radical Muslims generally will always prefer having sex with goats to women anyway, and you would think, therefore, that they don't really care for the porn business, because, you know, alcohol and porn, in theory, are supposed to be forbidden to them. But I think maybe it has not come up because it's something that's not yet on their radar. Pamela Geller talks about doing a Draw Muhammad contest and two assassins show up. And yet every day there is this stuff in the porn world, and maybe the porn groups have just not caught wind of it yet, or the Muslim groups have just not caught wind of it yet. Maybe they're or maybe they feel it's beneath them to even mix with. You know, remember, a lot of these loons don't even touch women. You know, they're not supposed to shake hands with them. They're not supposed to lay eyes on them. So maybe this is something that their own superstitions are keeping them from paying attention to. And I'm not talking about all Muslims. My understanding is the Muslim world is a huge consumer of porn, but I'm just talking about those loons that really hold fast to these superstitions. Maybe this is a world they feel is so corrupting that they don't even want to blow it up.
Yeah, it's almost like they'd have to admit that they'd seen it in the first place to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm just offering a theory because I don't really know, but it is interesting that as of now, it is yet to go on the radar. And plus, there's a good deal of anonymity in porn. My porn girl is outed now because she decided to. She got a role in the movie Aquaman that's coming out in December, the Marvel, the DC Warner Brothers film. And she just figured, well, I might as well just say who I am and maybe get some publicity for the fact that there's going to be a hardcore porn girl in Aquaman. But when we had the firewall erected between her name, her real name, and a porn name, we enforced it, and so did the porn companies. It would have been very difficult for somebody 2 years ago to watch a Kirsten Lee movie and try to find out who this woman really is. And so the smarter porn girls and the better porn companies, they keep that firewall pretty strong. I mean, the women get outed normally when they want to out themselves.
As porn becomes increasingly socially acceptable, which I think it's fair to say that it is, even though there's definitely still a stigma, I see more and more people online being more and more open about watching porn, and more people even being open about working within porn. Do you think some of these dynamics that you're talking about, where it's kind of a bastion of free speech and a lot of kind of very seedy and politically incorrect content, do you think that could come under threat?
Yeah, I think the left is even worse than the lunatic Muslims. I think the left truly cannot abide any arm of the entertainment industry, especially one as profitable as porn. They can't abide this going on. They've already started laying the groundwork. There's a lawsuit that I mentioned in my article where a black male porn actor is suing a porn director for telling the white girl in the scene to say the N-word to her, to him. So, and they're suing, and all the liberal groups are behind this. We got to get the racism out of porn, This will be an interesting fight, because it will be a fight between the typical leftist fanatics against an industry that doesn't necessarily give a shit. The porn industry is not going to bend like every other part of the entertainment industry is.
Yeah, that goes back. I mean, I was thinking, because most of their customers and audience are men, but it goes back because they're catering directly to their niche audience. Well, with Hollywood, they're trying to cater to the general masses. That's the key difference.
Yeah, yeah. And there is an honesty. There's an honesty to porn, whether it's good or bad. But they know what their fan base wants. I mean, it really, in a way, it comes down to the fact that, you know, the left, just in general society, is trying to engineer things that can't be re-engineered. It's trying to say, you should like trannies. Trannies are great, and every man should find a tranny attractive and not worry about the fact that this person was a man and then started dressing as a woman. Well, I mean, you're monkeying with the core DNA there. I mean, if a guy is not attracted to men, then he's not going to be attracted to men just because that man dons a dress and calls himself some new gender. Porn is all about just catering to the reality of what turns a guy on. And that could be anything. You could be turned on by women. You could be turned on by other men. You could be turned on by a man in drag. You could be turned on by getting peed on. But whatever it is, it's part of you, and it's really hard to engineer yourself out of it. If that could be done, we wouldn't have child molesters. If engineering yourself out of a fetish was that easy, well, then every dude who starts to like kids can just go to a seminar and get a switch turned off, and bam, they don't like kids anymore. But we all know child molesters are repeat offenders. They're repeat offenders because they can't turn that stuff off. Porn recognizes that whatever your fetish is, whatever your preference is, you're not going to be turning it off, and you're going to want to pay for it. And the more that maybe you can't see it in the legitimate entertainment world. I mean, an example. There was a cousin, a mentally retarded cousin of a friend of mine, whose thing was watching women beat up men. That's the porn that he would like. He was kind of retarded to the extent he had maybe the mentality of a 10-year-old. But he got off on watching women beat up men. So his relatives who he was living with, who were his caretakers, they made sure he had no access to porn. They cut off on his internet, on everything else. He couldn't see porn. But he would still just look for mainstream examples, from action films. And you see this all the time with the fad of female action heroes.
Have you seen the scene in the film The Crush where Alicia Silverstone walks into the empty, the busy business conference in her riding uniform and slaps Nick Elliott?
Yeah, yeah. Long time ago, but yeah, I saw the film. And if your thing is watching women abuse men, then you can find that in mainstream entertainment. But if you couldn't, if like all of a sudden that was, if we went back to the standards of the 1940s.
But did you know she actually had to use a body double for that film, for the nude scene?
I may have heard that. I forget what her age was back then, but I may have known that back then. What was she? I mean, how old was she when she did the Crush?
She was pretty young, maybe like 15. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. Then of course that would make sense. I know that like the actresses in Fast Times at Ridgemont High used body doubles. And by the way, that's another interesting thing about the porn biz. They take those laws really seriously. The respectable companies, I can't speak for the amateur ones, but the respectable companies, stuff about age and stuff about health requirements, during every month my porn girl would have to be recertified. We would drive out to the valley and she would get a checkup, a full-on checkup for any STDs, anything related. And one time, one particular month, she came back positive for chlamydia, and she could not do porn for a month until she was certified clear of chlamydia. But they take that stuff really seriously. You've got to show your certification on the set. And kind of the same with minors. They check your age, and they make sure that the kind of things like Tracy Lords that happened in the 80s and 90s, they make sure that doesn't happen again.
So there is they're very careful about checking the age, but there is a genre where they look very young, but that's legal as long as they're of age.
Well, and in fact, this circles right back to my own porn girl, Kara. She had very prepubescent-looking breasts. Pretty much body-wise, she looked like a 12-year-old, even though she was 21. One of the reasons she made so much money is because she looked like a teen. Now, she was 100% legal, 100% an adult, but naked, and because she looked young in the face as well, she could certainly have passed for a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old easily. So a lot of the stuff she did, she made an especially large amount of money from, because they do in fact look for the over 18s who look under 18s. They're not going to use an under 18 because they know, you know, this is a business about making money. You're not going to make money if the LAPD crashes in and you get prosecuted, but they do look for the 18 and overs who can play younger.
And yeah, that probably exists in gay porn too.
Oh, I can imagine, certainly. In fact, the guy who got my porn girl into porn was a gentleman in Austin who was what they call gay for pay. He was a young dude who himself was not gay, at least, you know, he wouldn't admit it, but he would make a lot of money being the young boy, and even though he was an adult, he was over 18, but he would make money doing gay porn. Of course, from my perspective, I'm like, well, you say you're not gay, but my gosh, the stuff you're doing. But that's just my own prejudice, not as a guy who would never do that kind of stuff. But yeah, you're right. The gay porn also uses the very young-looking boys.
I know there's like a lot of racial fetishes in porn, like the race play, the Asian porn, Asian fetish is huge. And there's a general perception that there's a lot of Jewish influence in the porn industry, but surprisingly there's very little porn of that genre. So if you were to go on a Tube site and type in, say, Jewish and blonde, like basically nothing would come up.
I don't know. That's something I probably should have looked into for my piece, because I don't know what
Matthew,
I will say.
Matthew, have you tried that?
I'm not sure I would admit it if I had, but I have not actually.
One thing I will say, because obviously I hear a lot from people like, the porn's a Jewish racket. In the case of my porn girl, her agent, who is one of the more legendary porn agents in the business, was an Irish-American, and a lot of the directors I ran into out here were Hispanic. Porn definitely was something that Jews, back when porn was especially forbidden, porn was something that Jews were very heavily behind as producers, because that's what we do. We produce movies. Any kind of movie, you'll find a Jew producing it. But out here, at least, and I can only speak for L.A., I can't speak for other markets, although my porn girl started in Orlando, and I think it's the same in Florida. In L.A. and Florida, there's a very strong Hispanic element, Cuban money and Cubans in Florida, and Mexicans have a kind of Hispanics out here. So I think I kind of look at it like communism, where the originators were heavily Jewish, but now you have these Puerto Ricans like that moron in New York who are carrying the torch for communism and are not Jewish at all. These things might be started by a certain group, but then they take on a life of their own because of their because they're attractive, either because they're profitable or in the case of communism because they're attractive for a lot of very, very negative ways. But still, what the group that starts it is not always the group that then ends up being the only people involved.
A lot of anti-Semites would point to Jewish involvement in porn as proof of their degeneracy. But I think my impression is that a lot of people who, for whatever reason, might find themselves on the outside of society and at a certain point that may have been Jews, do end up getting involved in pornography at a higher rate.
Yeah, and also, I mean, if porn's only customer base was Jewish, it would not make money. There's just not enough of us in the world. The customer base is almost, just outrageously not Jewish. Black and white, Arab and Hispanic and Asian. A Jewish pornographer would probably always give the excuse that, well, we're just giving the world what it wants, and there's truth to that. But whatever, you get all these, the Al Goldsteins and all the smut peddlers in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and they weren't all Jewish, but a lot of them were. But the business has just changed now, and most of the men I met who were in a producer capacity or a director capacity tended to be very kind of white Hispanics, kind of Americanized dudes with last names like Ramirez and Gonzalez and Rodriguez. They seem to be the most prevalent on the production end of the business right now.
Should we move on to the James Gunn article, or do you have anything else you'd like to add about this article?
No, I mean, it was something that I'd been figuring I'd get off my chest at some point because it's hard for me to experience something, anything, without then wanting to write about it. As long as my porn girl did not want it to be outed, as long as there was a firewall, I was never going to write about it. But once she let me know that she was fine with being revealed, well, at that point, you can't ask a guy like me to not write about something. It's cruel. It's inhuman.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So with James Gunn, I mean, this is kind of old news, but I still think it's worth talking about. It goes to the theme of censorship and whether to there are people who are just totally outraged by what he said, or whether to be consistent, or whether some people who view him as a political enemy have a schadenfreude, because on one hand, I mean, I pretty much agree with most of what you said, because let's face it, like, all three of us would probably be fired if we were working for him at Disney just because we have views that are not politically correct.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, I would like to see a culture where people should be free to express themselves, and not just the First Amendment under the law, even on social media, without any limits, as long as they're not explicitly breaking the law. Basically, pretty much within free speech, people should be free to express themselves no matter how offensive it is. So there's that angle, and but then the key question is, Should we take that position, or if he's someone who would say, punish us for our views, should we take a more kind of a little bit of a Machiavellian stance, or would you rather just take the high road and just say everyone should say whatever they want?
Well, one of the things that I tried to point out in my piece was that when someone has a theory about what may help their side or hurt the other side, well, you test that theory out. It was believed by several people, including Kurt Schlichter in Town Hall, and I knew Kurt. Kurt was a friend of mine. He's blocked me on social media everywhere, but I still like Kurt.
He's a good guy. Through the Friends of Abe Club?
Yeah, through the Friends of Abe and my own group, the Republican Party Animals, which was just another arm of Friends of Abe, and Kurt Schlichter would come to. I met Kurt because there's a very popular right of center blogger who goes by the name of Iowa Hawk, and or Dave Berg. That is not his real name. He like has his blog name, then he has his phony human name. Neither of them are his real name. But Dave Berg would come to my events, and he would bring Kurt Schlichter with him. And I like Kurt a lot. But Kurt in Town Hall, when the James Gunn thing first exploded, Kurt was like, yes, we take one of them for every one of us that they take, and soon enough they'll be worn down and we'll take a scalp for a scalp and they'll finally give up. And that didn't happen. We did, and I say we, people like Kurt Schlichter, people like Cernovich, Bisobiec, they completely destroyed James Gunn. He got fired from one of the most profitable franchises in movie history, and against the wishes of his cast, against the wishes of the fans, but Disney fired him, and they got their scalp. But all they did is ramp up the attacks against the right within the weeks following James Gunn's firing. Well, Gavin McInnes gets banned, Proud Boys get banned from Twitter. Candace Owens gets banned. Stephen Molyneux, they go after him. So I don't think the scalp for a scalp thing will work, because James Gunn may have been profitable to Disney, but he was not some intellectual giant of the left. Al Franken is a better example of scalp for a scalp working, because that hurt the left. When the left was pounding away against Roy Moore in that election, Roy Moore, he does things to women, he's disrespectful to women, he's a groper, he chases the skirts of young women. And then Al Franken, all this stuff comes out about him last year. Well, that hurt the left. When Al Franken was forced to resign, the left was not happy about that. They're still not happy about that. Al Franken was being talked about as a potential presidential candidate or vice presidential candidate. And then he leaves, he resigns. No one was happy about that. The left had to do that because bringing down Roy Moore was more important. And now the dust is settled and Roy Moore is history, they don't like the fact that they don't have Al Franken anymore. So I think if you're going to talk about scalp for a scalp, politicians and sexual misconduct, scalp for a scalp works there, and it works for a couple of reasons. Number one, politicians have a different standard to be held to than comedians or movie directors. A comedian or a movie director did not sign up to represent decency. A politician supposedly needs to represent certain principles, whether they do or not, they're supposed to. So for a politician who accuses someone else of improper conduct, and then like Keith Ellison in Michigan these days, right now, that's something going on. So Keith Ellison accuses other politicians of sexual misconduct, then he gets accused of it. Well, I'm all in favor of a scalp for a scalp there, because A, politicians have assumed the responsibility to behave well, and B, that does hurt the left when we take down a Franken and maybe we take down someone like Keith Ellison. The left does get hurt. The left wasn't hurt because a guy who does a talking raccoon movie gets fired. It doesn't matter to them. The left's plans did not hinge on James Gunn doing part three of the talking raccoon movie. Nothing that the left wanted hinged on that. So yeah, we took down James Gunn. Big whoop, big deal. I feel bad for him, and I was against it because my fetish is not sexual. My fetish, I love bad movies, I love bad humor. I love just raw, stupid jokes, politically incorrect jokes.
Yeah, you make a good point that basically when it comes to comedy, nothing should be off limits. So, no joke is too based, too disgusting, just let it all out. And I mean, even I remember a while back, and this was before Louis C.K. had his Me Too incident, Louis C.K. made some joke of the same subject matter, and all these people were just outraged. I think it was SNL, but
Yeah, right. His monologue, the SNL monologue he did.
Yeah, but I don't think he really said anything wrong. I thought it was. I think he was like challenging people's. He was basically challenging the audience and using dark satire to do so.
He was doing what a good comedian should do, and Louis C.K. was a good comedian. I'm not saying he's a good man or a good human being, but he was very good at what he did. And what he was doing in that monologue was something that that a lot of people were thinking. But no one wanted to say. And yeah, he was simply challenging the audience's perceptions and the audience's the things, the dark parts of their own mind they didn't want to go into. And that's what a good comedian does. And it's a shame that Louis C.K., you know, was such a prick in real life. That's probably not even the best word to use, considering what he would do in front of women. But it's a shame. He was very good. He was a very skilled comedian, and I never would have been in favor of anything of him being censored or silenced in any way because of his routines. And I'm that way with every comedian and every filmmaker. I just don't believe that that this segment of the arts should be regulated in any way, either by government, and we don't have it regulated by government. We're not like the UK. We're not like Australia. We don't have it regulated by the government. But the left has tried to create a kind of superstructure in the private sector where people can be shot down for telling jokes. I mean, this only happened 2 days ago, so it's probably old news by now, but about 2 days ago, it's like 5 in the morning. I'm drunk, like I always am at 5 in the morning. I have not been sober at 5 in the morning for 15 years. And all of a sudden, I see on Twitter, Norm Macdonald, one of my favorite stand-ups, to me, one of the great comic geniuses working today. Norm Macdonald is trolling the hell out of Lena Dunham. And he's merciless. Macdonald is going to every single tweet that Lena Dunham had made, and she's a very prolific tweeter. So the tons of material, tons of stuff. And he's going to every tweet she's done in the last few weeks, and he's trolling it. He's mocking it. And I'm watching this unfold in real time, and I'm saying to my friends, my gosh, look at this. I mean, there were a few people still up at 5 a.m., probably not drunks like me, a couple people who have jobs that they have to get to by 6. But I'm saying, you got to see this. Norm Macdonald is just, he's reaming Lena Dunham, tweet after tweet after tweet. And it was a joy to behold. And then I pass out. I go to sleep, as I always do. I wake up in a daze at 1 p.m. or 2 p.m., and I go back on my computer. And it's gone. He erased all of it because he was afraid that she would be offended. And I thought, my God, what kind of world are we living in? His trolling was quite funny. He wasn't doing stuff like, you're a fat bitch. Anyone can do that. There's no skill there. There's no skill in trolling Lena Dunham by saying, you're a fat, ugly bitch. But he was trolling her very skillfully, and yet even this guy, this very brave comedian, I mean, he's actually brave because he does a lot of politically incorrect stuff, but even he felt the pressure to erase all of those tweets and erased a whole lot of comedy, a whole lot of really funny stuff, which I thought was a terrible shame.
It kind of seems like comedy used to be a little bit more like what porn is now, where there was a sense that you could say racialist things or just generally or sexist things or generally politically incorrect things, and it would be written off, you know, within reason, in the name of comedy. But that's definitely changed over the past 5 or 10 years.
Even some of those like jokes on Californication about the casting couch wouldn't fly under the Me Too climate.
Yeah, I was always really struck with Californication. I just finished watching that entire series a few months back, and that ended in 2014, which wasn't really that long ago, but already just it's completely unimaginable that a show even half as politically incorrect as that would ever be on Showtime now.
100% correct, yeah. And if you go back to some of the stand-ups from the years when I was a teenager, you go back to someone like Sam Kinison, some of his best routines were stuff that I don't think could air these days. He would be on national TV making fun of starving Ethiopians. That's actually still one of the best routines I've ever seen a stand-up do, was him making fun of the Ethiopian famine. Well, you can't do that now, and Kinison would make jokes about the opposite sex that you can't do now. Andrew Dice Clay would make jokes about the opposite. Andrew Dice Clay was never as skilled as Kinison, but still, he had his moments. And you have all of these comedians from the 80s who came of age, and then you have the ones who became successful in the 90s doing politically incorrect stuff, who then renounced it. Best examples, which I mentioned in my article, Jimmy Kimmel. We would have no Jimmy Kimmel without The Man Show. And The Man Show was all about girls with boobs jumping on trampolines, girls with boobs doing booby stuff. And Jimmy Kimmel was all about ogling boobs. Oh, look at the boobs, look at the boobs, look at the boobs. And now he's remade himself into Mr. Johnny Carson, and he's crying on TV about his son not being able to get health care. And he's renounced what made him famous. And his ex-girlfriend, Sarah Silverman, same thing. Sarah Silverman became famous in the 90s by telling racial jokes. I mean, one of my favorites that she did on Conan O'Brien on national TV on NBC. She was doing a bit, and one of the best things that she used to do, you didn't know she was doing a bit. You would think she was talking about her real life. So she says, yeah, you know, I'm dating a guy now. He's half black, and I'm really concerned that he's going to break up with me. Oh, wait, that sounded really negative. I meant to say he's half white. And that was on Conan. She not only won't do that material now, but she has renounced it. She has specifically said that she no longer would do the material she did when she was younger. So you have a generation of these comedians who became wealthy and became famous doing stuff that they now are trying to prevent other comedians from doing. It is kind of like, you know, burning someone else's bridge. It's like you've crossed the bridge, and now you're going to torch that bridge so that nobody else can follow you.
Yeah, the hypocrisy of it is astounding. I mean, I work in a creative field, and there really is this sense that I have that certain bridges have been burnt. It's really a very toxic atmosphere for any kind of up and coming artist, because everyone is so petrified of what they can and can't say. And all these people that, as you point out, got famous and probably wouldn't have gotten famous otherwise for certain edgy jokes and things that they used to do are kind of gatekeeping this politically correct culture now. And I mean, it's a very bad atmosphere for new and up and coming artists, I think, in multiple different fields. But at the same time, I think it can be said that Hollywood and some of these institutions are getting so alienated, or getting so far away from what the average American consumer actually wants, that we may there may come a time where it's, and maybe that time is already upon us to some extent, where the profit margins really start to drop. And I just don't know how much longer it can continue.
And that will create like a vacuum for new alternative media, as long as the people who are trying to do something new and innovative, who have those innovative ideas, whether it's art or comedy, have the venue. I think there is this demand for that.
Well, look at how fragmented the business has become. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, everything made a certain amount of sense. You have your three networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. Fox was not around yet. And then you have your movie studios, Warner Brothers, Universal, movies get released in theaters. And we see how they do on their opening weekend, and we judge whether they're a hit or a bomb. TV series debut in September, and within a month we know if they're a hit or a miss. Those days are so gone, because the business is now fragmented. You have people watching Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, YouTube Red, or whatever they're calling their pay service now, people are now much more able to go to things that cater to them. The big releases, the big movie releases, are almost entirely now superhero films. As long as the public has an appetite for that stuff, I understand that stuff even less than I understand porn. But okay, people love it. People love it. They want to see guys fighting CGI monsters. Great, beautiful, enjoy it. But that's the only real thing where we talk about, ooh, tentpole movies and opening weekend, Superman, Dawn of Justice did not do as big as it should have done. But generally, more and more, it's all about niche marketing. It is all about you go to Netflix and Amazon Prime and you watch the stuff that you want to watch. And there's no longer any metric of the opening weekend. These online services, these streaming services, they canceled a few days ago. They canceled Michelle Wolf's supposed comedy show, which I was very happy to see because I just think she's terrible. Not because of her politics. She's a bad comedian. She's not funny. But she'll get another show somewhere. Right now is the age of the niche market. I don't think people on the right, or even just right-leaning, have taken advantage of that like we should. Everyone is online looking for content. And yes, so we're getting banned from YouTube, and we're getting banned from here, and we're getting banned from there. But starting a service that is more a little bit to the right, but not polemical. I'll tell you a very quick anecdote. This was something we were always talking about at Friends of Abe. We were always saying, let's start our own network, a conservative network for entertainment, not for news, but for entertainment, and we'll do entertainment stuff from a conservative perspective. It never worked. They tried it. They tried it with something called the Right Network that Kelsey Grammer put like $2 million into, and it didn't work because it was polemical. It was not about entertainment. Glenn Beck tried it also with Glenn Beck TV. But right now, just a streaming service that wasn't even necessarily always on the right, but just free to show, to willing to put things on that were right and left. You know, I've always said I don't want dominance for my views. I want them out there. I want an equal shake. I would never want a network that's only right wing.
That's the problem with Gab, that it basically becomes an echo chamber.
Yeah, entirely. And so I don't think that people who lean to the right are making enough of an effort to take advantage of how the business has changed and how this whole niche market, the boutique online networks, there's stuff that can be done here. No one's really doing it. I would love to see that whoever that billionaire Texas family that's behind Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire, boy, you know, they could take their dairy money, or the money they spend on eggs and milk per month, put it into something like that.
The problem with conservatives in entertainment is a lot of them are very, very conservative about what they will show. So exactly. We were talking about The Moralist and their hysteria about James Gunn's joke, and just imagine something far more less offensive than that would not be allowed on a conservative network. So in a sense, I'm kind of more interested in reviving a apocalypse culture than doing all these conservative projects. And I mean, Matthew, you know what I'm talking about, basically.
Yeah, definitely. Robert and I have actually recently launched something called Stark Truth TV, which hasn't released anything yet, but we have a forthcoming documentary on Luke Ford that we're going to release.
Right. Yeah,
YouTube.
Robert was mentioning that to me, and I think that's a great idea. And I think it's very necessary, because that thing I was mentioning with Friends of Abe, the Right Network, fell apart because it turns out Kelsey Grammer only wanted to do biblical stuff. And so he didn't want to do anything where it was, we had a lot of kind of neocon Jews in the group who were not into the biblical stuff. They were more into slamming Muslims and things like that. And Grammer only wanted to do Christian stuff. So I think what you're talking about very much is what's necessary. What Adam Parfrey was always trying to do with Feral House, which is give a voice to some of the things in culture that just would not normally have a voice.
Did Adam Parfrey publish your books?
Yeah, Adam Parfrey was my publisher and also my friend for like 30 years. He's a man who had a vision. Unfortunately, it is not shared by the people who took over Feral House. I don't think in another year that we're going to ever see anything interesting come out of Feral House again, because it was all him. It was all him as a person. He didn't really develop a business where he surrounded himself with people who had the same vision, in a way, because his vision was so unique. There are not a lot of Adam Parfreys. There are very few people who are as open to just exploring stuff that is offensive, possibly even offensive to them. Adam Parfrey would, some of the stuff he put out was left wing, some of it was right wing, some of it was indecipherable, and some of it was not, it couldn't be categorized as left or right. But it died with him. And I think with his death, with his very untimely death in May, I think we've seen the end of Feral House as a concern.
And yeah,
it's very sad.
Yeah, it's very sad, and it's important to kind of to find people that kind of who take up that theme of just not being selective. Because what was remarkable at Adam Parfrey and Feral House is it was a kind of free for all. So any topic that was taboo could be mentioned. So you might have themes on the far right that were offensive. But then he'd also publish someone like Peter Sotos and just all kinds of topics because, I mean, what kind of originally attracted me to the alt-right is what is kind of an escape from political correctness. But then when I got involved with that scene, they have their own kind of boundaries of what you can and can't say as well. So it's sure. Very rare to find a group that just basically you can be totally free to express yourselves.
Yeah, Parfrey looked at books the same way that I look at jokes. It's either funny or it isn't. And Parfrey looked at books like they are either well-written and entertaining or they're not. But he didn't look at it from the point of view of, I want to cram an agenda down anyone's throat. If a book was written by someone who is far left or far right or in the center or whatever, if it's a good book, well-written and engaging, Parfrey would publish it. He never became wealthy. He was always able to break even. That was his the greatest thing that he would brag about was that for 20 years he was able to keep that company going and keep it from going under. But he never became a millionaire at it, and that's another reason nobody's going to pick up that and continue that legacy, because you're not going to get terribly wealthy at it.
Are you familiar with Soto's work and his issues of censorship?
Roughly. I mean, I don't know him, but I'm certainly familiar with the issues. And Parfrey, several times, has published stuff that got him in trouble legally. I mean, I think, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but he was actually sued by one of the Watergate people for the book... what was it called? White House Madam. I didn't read it. It wasn't one I read, but it was one that came out, I think, in 2013. But Parfrey was often getting sued, and his books were often getting pulled. Jim Goad, another longtime friend of mine, Jim Goad got in tremendous amount of trouble back in the 90s when he and his wife were writing and publishing Answer Me. And I think there was only five... editions of Answer Me ever published. There was the rape issue, the race issue, the murder issue, the suicide issue. I think there's one I'm forgetting. This is still, in my opinion, some of the finest stuff that's ever been written. Jim Goad and his wife Debbie, his late wife Debbie, tremendous writers, and me starting out in Holocaust revisionism around that same time, the very early 90s, I was enthralled by this, and Parfrey introduced me to Jim Goad in 91. And I loved the fact that there's just no boundaries with him about what he would joke about and what he would write about. And Parfrey ended up publishing some of Goad's work. Goad and I were both, I mean, this is just sort of, I'm not saying this to be bitter, it doesn't matter one way or the other, but Goad and I were kind of shut out of the Parfrey Memorial because I don't think that's the direction Feral House is ever going to go in again.
On that particularly, I did have one thought to go back to the James Gunn issue. I think it's worth pointing out that we're kind of dancing around here. There's two different factions, or many more than two, but different factions within the right. Some folks really are free speech absolutists, people like Adam Parfrey, people such as yourself, David, I think probably you as well, Robert, and I would probably identify this with this as well, where, you know, we are free speech absolutists. We're definitely open to really all manner of different perspectives and kind of delving into what Adam Parfrey would have called, like, forbidden knowledge. But there's also a lot of people on the right and then the alt-right that are actually not for free speech at all. I'm not going to name names, but I think they'd be very open about this.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people in the alt-right who would actually go as far as to say, I think someone did, I forget who it was, a major conservative icon said that James Gunn should be in prison for his comments, that we even went that far.
Yeah.
So it's a, I mean, there's been a general fracturing of the alt-right. We've heard a lot about this if you follow it. And I think a lot of divisions are coming out, and I think one of them is definitely between people who have a really kind of Puritan might be too strong a word, but that kind of a vision for, you know, white identity politics or whatever you want to call it, and then others, and I'd count myself among them, who are have a much more general interest in kind of forbidden perspectives and harder truths.
And a lot of them...
Yeah, very true, very
yeah,
true.
Yeah, a lot of them literally believe that James Gunn is part of this secretive Pizzagate pedophile cabal.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what you get on the some in some strains of alt-right, you get people who are, on the one hand, very conspiratorial and like to see conspiracies everywhere, but also there's a very strong and very unfortunate authoritarian strain in the alt-right. You have people who want to pretty much abolish democracy, women shouldn't vote, and we create the white ethno-state and ship people out in train cars. I mean, this is all just fanciful talk. It's never going to happen. And I always think there's nothing more funny and pathetic at the same time than seeing guys with absolutely no power, no influence at all. Whether they're living in their mom's basement, which is kind of a cliche, or whether they're just sort of living with their girlfriend in a seedy apartment, but they're online about it. And here's how I shall reshape the world, and here's how I shall remake government. And you get that with the alt-right, you get that with libertarians, you get that with all strains of that. And it's very sad, because it's not going to happen. But this authoritarian strain that exists in the alt-right, where they do want to ban things, you know, banning things is, it's very appealing to a lot of people, and it's appealing to people on the left. The people on the left who want to ban things happen to be the ones right now who are represented by the mainstream media. So the people on the left who want to ban things, they have more of a voice. But there are equally people on the right who would like to ban things. It doesn't really matter left or right. There are always going to be a certain amount of people who want to ban things.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank David Cole and Matthew Pegas for being on. It's been a really great show.
I have enjoyed it very, very much, Robert. Thank you. Anytime. I am always a humble and willing guest of yours.
Okay. Great talking to you guys.